Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Well, the year 2019 has come and gone, and a new year spreads before us. Today on our program, we want to take a look back at some of the year's biggest stories and also take a look ahead as to what 2020 may have in store for us. So relax and enjoy our welcoming of the new year, all ahead on VOA Asia Weekend. U.S. President Donald Trump was assured of a place in history this month when the U.S. House of Representatives voted to impeach him for his efforts to pressure Ukraine to investigate political rival Joe Biden. Trump is expected to be acquitted in an impeachment trial, if it happens, early next year in the Republican-controlled Senate. But the political fallout from the impeachment drama may prove to be a factor in the 2020 presidential election. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has that story from Washington.
Please welcome the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
In times of trouble, President Trump can always count on the warm embrace of his political base. Even as the House voted to impeach him, Trump lashed out at Democrats at a rally in Michigan.
You are the ones interfering in America's elections. You are the ones subverting America's democracy. We did nothing wrong, nothing whatsoever. This was just an excuse.
Article 1 is adopted.
House Democrats said they impeached Trump because they could not ignore the president's attempts to enlist Ukraine's help in his reelection bid in 2020. Maryland Congressman Steny Hoyer.
This impeachment asks whether we are still a republic of laws, as our founders intended, or whether we will accept that one person can be above the law.
The president's chances of surviving impeachment are much brighter in the Senate, where Republicans are poised to acquit him in a trial, including Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
This particular House of Representatives has let its partisan rage at this particular president create a toxic new precedent that will echo well into the future.
Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer said his party will press the case.
I have little doubt that if we tell the president that he can escape scrutiny in this instance, he will do it again and again and again.
Democrats and Republicans expect impeachment to be a factor in next year's presidential election, says Julie Pace.
It's just a huge unknown. Both parties think that this could play to their favor, and privately both parties think it could work against them. But we just haven't been in this situation before where you have an impeachment and then that impeached president running for reelection.
The impeachment saga has consumed Washington in recent months. But voters have short memories, warns University of Virginia expert Larry Sabato.
This is going to be much less significant by next November than people think. It's going to seem like an eon past. And that means other controversies, other issues. The two candidates, Democrat and Republican, will dominate the election, not impeachment.
Public opinion polls show the country remains sharply divided on impeachment. And the lengthy process in the House did little to alter that dynamic, says analyst Capri Cafaro.
But I think what's happened with impeachment is that it really hasn't had any significant impact in changing minds. I think it has solidified the camp.
The Senate will take up the issue of Trump's fitness for office in January. But the ultimate verdict is expected to be rendered by U.S. voters in the election next November. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And if you haven't guessed, you can be sure that this is a story not going anywhere in 2020. So keep it tuned to VOA for all the latest throughout the year, or visit us at Facebook, VOA Asia. VOA Asia Weekend continues. China's direct investment in the U.S. has slowed to a trickle, dropping 80% from 2016 to 2018, according to New York-based research provider Rhodium Group. Among the hardest-hit sectors are real estate and hospitality, with Chinese investors no longer scrambling to buy prime properties in cities like New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports on what's behind this downward trend and how it's impacting one American city in particular.
The Los Angeles skyline can be seen from Stephen Chung's office, but something is missing. And what he is not seeing worries him.
The skylines are no longer filled with cranes or supplied by Chinese investments coming over here. What we're worried about are the construction that's already here that cannot be finished because of the financing situation.
Chung says one example of this is the billion-dollar Oceanwide Plaza, located in a prized location near the Los Angeles Convention Center and the complex where the Lakers and Clippers play basketball. Work stalled in January for this condo, hotel, and retail space, and Chung has seen very little activity since then.
In terms of people moving to that location and actually the retail activity that's going to be there, that's revenue that we will not be getting as soon as we hope.
The standstill at Oceanwide Plaza is but one sign of a sharp drop in capital flowing from China at a time of heightened tensions between the two superpowers. Overall direct foreign investment between China and the U.S. peaked in 2016 to a record $60 billion, then dropped drastically, according to the Rhodium Group. One reason is a change in China's monetary policy, says Los Angeles-based land use lawyer Dale Goldsmith.
There were the currency controls out of China, where a lot of companies were parking money. I think it was probably to get money out of China and into a safe investment. And at the end of the day, the Chinese cracked down on that.
Another reason is increased vigilance by a federal watchdog organization, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. The Rhodium Group estimates the committee's scrutiny has led Chinese investors to abandon more than $2.5 billion in U.S. deals. A relatively strong U.S. economy is another factor.
The dollar has been very strong, making investment a lot less attractive for the Chinese in the States. On top of it, you have skyrocketing construction costs.
To top it all off, a trade war persists between the U.S. and China, sowing uncertainty in an already challenging investment climate.
Part of the reason why we're seeing really not any new projects coming from China is because of the China trade war, not knowing the future. And as the tensions escalating, I think a lot of the Chinese companies are wary in terms of whether they should enter the U.S. market.
The trade war is creating another trend. To avoid high tariffs, international companies are moving manufacturing out of China and into Southeast Asian countries. In some countries, it's creating new wealth. Others are trying to increase their direct foreign investment to offset the trade war's negative effects in their own countries.
Specifically Vietnam and Indonesia. Over the past few years, they've been a lot more active seeking for business opportunities.
So long as economic tensions remain high between Washington and Beijing, Los Angeles and other U.S. cities will have to look elsewhere for investment capital. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. With VOA Asia, also follow radio program hosts VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
North Korea has been making lots of headlines over the last year and will likely continue to do the same. But another story like that of North Korea is the conflict between India and Pakistan over the state of Kashmir. And much like North Korea, not only does it seem intractable, but also presents the threat of nuclear weaponry. Earlier this year, India effectively closed off Kashmir to the rest of the world. The result has been an escalation of tensions between the two nuclear-armed Southeast Asian rivals. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Sumit Ganguly, professor of political science at Indiana University, about where we are and what can be done.
It has certainly been an incendiary area, and this decision could inflame passions in the region considerably in the days and months ahead of us, largely because people will feel disenfranchised, that they had always felt that that they had a distinctive identity within the Indian Union, and that identity now is being effaced. Kashmir joined the Indian Union under very special circumstances at the time of the partition of India in 1947, and consequently it had this special dispensation. Now that special dispensation, with the stroke of a pen, has been removed, and consequently this may well lead to considerable disenchantment among significant segments of the population, especially in the valley of Kashmir.
And what about Pakistan's stance here?
Pakistan will raise this issue not only at home and mobilize its population against India, but will also raise this matter in various international fora, and certainly in September when the United Nations General Assembly meets in New York.
Is this a religious confrontation?
There is an element of religion involved, in that this is the only Muslim majority state in India, and the government in India is an avowedly Hindu nationalist government, and they have a little or no regard for the sentiments of Muslims, and feel that Muslims in the valley of Kashmir, which is predominantly Muslim, is a predominantly Muslim area, have been pampered by previous governments, and that they have always enjoyed special privileges, and these special privileges are inappropriate and need to be done away with, and the region now needs to be fully integrated into India and treated like any other part of India.
There has been violence between India and Pakistan over Kashmir for quite a while, but especially over the past year or so. Tell us about that and what happens now.
There have been at least three wars between India and Pakistan over Kashmir in 1947-48, in 1965, and most recently in 1999. Since about 1989, there has been an ongoing insurgency in the Indian-controlled portion of Kashmir. By about the mid-1990s, the government managed to contain the insurgency to a considerable degree, but despite if not the termination, but at least the decline of the insurgency from the mid-1990s, there has still been periodic outbreaks of violence and periodic acts of terror sponsored by Pakistan in Kashmir. And there has also been protest movements within Kashmir, which are largely indigenous. And the government of India has fairly harshly repressed these protest movements, which in turn has generated further passions.
Does the nuclear capabilities of both Pakistan and India play any part in this?
They do play a role, and there is an important debate about this. Some scholars argue this makes the region much more brittle and fragile and dangerous and fraught with risk. Others argue that nuclear weapons actually have a stabilizing effect, because neither side can really contemplate a full-scale war for fear of escalation to the nuclear level. And consequently, both sides have an interest in limiting the scope of conflict, that they might provoke each other, but they know the limits that they can go to in terms of these forms of provocation. So there is a vigorous debate about this, and there is no agreement on this subject in the scholarly community.
Which way do you go on this? Do you see nuclear weapons as a deterrent?
I do see nuclear weapons as a deterrent, and have written as much and have debated various people on this subject. I do believe that nuclear weapons actually, in a paradoxical way, contribute to stability in the region, and we have not seen the onset of full-scale war since the nuclearization of the region. Both sides have exercised a degree of caution and circumspection for fear of engaging an escalatory spiral.
Indiana University's Sumit Ganguly speaking with our Ira Melman. And you're listening to VOA Asia Weekend.
Following comes to UMN Radio from the Voice of America.
I'm Ira Melman in Washington with Healthy Living. A cleft lip or palate is one of the most common birth defects among infants. In developed countries like the U.S., corrective surgeries are often performed during the first couple of years of a child's life. But in some places, like Pakistan, there are thousands of children with the birth defect, but not enough doctors who can perform the corrective surgery. Now there's hope, thanks to a group of volunteers. VOA's Asim Ali Rana has more from Gujarat, Pakistan, in this report narrated by Bezan Hamdard.
About 1 in 700 children around the world are born with a cleft lip and palate defect every year. In Pakistan, children not only have trouble eating and drinking, they're also facing difficult psychological and social challenges. A simple plastic surgery could correct the defect. But in Pakistan, many families can't afford the procedure, and even if they could, there aren't enough doctors who perform it, says experts.
There's a huge problem in terms of cleft in Pakistan. You have some very, very good local surgeons who are doing large volumes of cleft surgery, but the volume of cleft in Pakistan is so large that they cannot deal with all of these cases.
Hill is part of a charity program organized by Aisha Bashir Trust, which brings teams of doctors to Pakistan to help with the shortage of physicians. Dr. Hill is one of many doctors from the United Kingdom visiting Cleft Hospital Pakistan in the northeastern city of Gujarat to perform cleft treatments for free.
It's important, I think, to collaborate with surgeons from abroad to try and increase the training of local surgeons, and that's what we're doing here. There are local trainees and other local consultants that we work with.
Dr. Riaz, who works with the charity, says he's amazed by this simple display of humanity.
We need to praise the ones who come here for pure humanitarian reasons. Our senior colleague who started this whole charity in England has no connections to Pakistan, no religious reasons of being here. It is purely for humanity. And for the past 20 years, he hasn't missed a single trip.
Speech therapist Dr. Rosie Slater says cleft surgery sometimes is just the beginning of the process.
The surgery only does so much. Speech therapy needs to go hand in hand with the surgery. So it's a really good opportunity to be able to come here and work as part of a team here to really help the children.
A simple surgery and a rich reward of a lifetime of smiles. For Asim Ali Rana in Gujarat, Pakistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Make sure you join us next week for Healthy Living. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
That was a program from the Voice of America.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Worldwide, more than 140,000 people died from measles in 2018. That number is expected to rise in 2019. These are according to new estimates from the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. These deaths occurred as measles cases surged globally amid devastating outbreaks in all regions. Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the NIH in Bethesda. He recently told our Ira Melman that measles, once almost considered extinct, is now a serious problem.
Well, measles is one of the most highly contagious infectious diseases known to man. It is really true. If someone has measles and goes into a room and coughs and sneezes, measles in the air and in the environment can last anywhere from 2 to 4 hours, and someone who even walks into that room without direct contact with the person who has measles, but measles had been in a particular space, that person can get measles. So it's highly contagious. The other thing is that the vaccine against measles is one of the most effective vaccines known to man. It's about 97% effective. But in order to prevent outbreaks, you need the community to have a level of vaccination of approximately 93-94%. In Samoa, it was as low as 50-55%. So it made the population of Samoa very vulnerable to an outbreak of measles, which is exactly what we are seeing right now. But what has happened now is a catastrophe, since so few individuals, percentage-wise, were vaccinated. There have now been thousands of cases, and at least 60 people have died thus far, which really belies this issue that measles is not a serious disease. It is a terribly serious disease in its potential and can kill and cause a degree of disease and suffering, as we are currently seeing in Samoa.
So why do you think their vaccination level was as low as it was?
Well, it was a combination of reasons. You know, one of them was just letting it slip, so the public health accessibility to vaccines was not great. And then there was an unfortunate situation, which was a public relations problem. The public didn't trust the vaccine because there was an accident, a mistake some time ago, where vaccine was improperly mixed with a muscle relaxant, leading to the death of two infants, which led to a field day on the part of the anti-vaxxers because they used that accidental adverse event as a way of preaching to the people that vaccines are dangerous and you shouldn't use them. And that unfortunately led to a very strong anti-vaccine movement in Samoa, which was the major contribution to this problem.
Has there ever been a situation like this where almost all of the population, at least in recent times, all of the population has been exposed to the disease and so many have come down with it?
Well, sure. It was the pre-vaccination era. This is exactly what happened prior to the development of a safe and effective vaccine for measles. We had outbreaks like this all over the world. So this is not anything that's new or novel. It's just turning the clock back to the time when we didn't have vaccines. As I mentioned, only about 50-55% of the people in Samoa are vaccinated. You've got to get that vaccine level up above 90%.
So what's the best thing they can do, and are they doing it already?
They are. They are. The government right now is putting a very aggressive, proactive program to vaccinate as many people as possible. In fact, they're reverting to some old public health tactics of having people signify their homes by hanging red flags outside the house in which people have not been vaccinated in order to facilitate the teams that are embarking on a door-to-door vaccination campaign.
Sounds like the plague, doesn't it?
Well, you know, it does in some respects, but they're doing the measures. They're getting help from the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The U.S. CDC has sent consultants down there to give them technical assistance with tracking and monitoring.
What are the worst areas when it comes to people being exposed to measles, and how bad is it on a worldwide scale?
Well, on a worldwide scale, there are still outbreaks throughout the world in countries that don't have it. You know, prior to the vaccination being available, there were a couple of million deaths each year from measles in the United States. There was 400 to 500 deaths per year prior to the time that we had vaccines in the early to mid-1960s. Currently, there are still countries in which the vaccination level is low, and you do have outbreaks of measles. Measles has not been eliminated in the world.
So what are the areas that are most affected?
Well, the areas that are most affected in some of the underdeveloped countries in sub-Saharan Africa, some of the Asian countries, some countries where there's war and natural disasters, such as in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. That's, you know, an unstable area that's beset by Ebola, also has a measles problem. Afghanistan, Pakistan, certain sections of India are areas where you have measles problems.
The NIH's Dr. Anthony Fauci speaking with Ira Melman.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter following VOA News, either on the radio or online at voanews.com/encounter. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to encounter@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
About 2 million children in Afghanistan are acutely malnourished. Of those, 600,000 face severe acute malnutrition, the most dangerous form of undernutrition in children, said Christopher Bouliarek, a spokesman for the UN Children's Fund. But as Lisa Schlein reports for VOA, UNICEF is struggling to fund its operation.
The report, the first of its kind, provides an intimate look into the progress being made in improving the nutritional status of India's 1.3 billion people by addressing the country's severe food shortages. While progress is being made toward this goal, World Food Programme spokesman Hervé Verhussel says India is still far away from wiping out hunger in the country.
The report indicates that despite positive trends and patterns in improving food security, malnutrition rates are well below acceptable levels, with large number of people, especially women and children, suffering from vitamin A, iron, and iodine deficiency.
The report indicates stunting has declined by one-fifth in India during the last decade. Nevertheless, it notes 6.4% of children under 5 are both stunted and wasted, and also are underweight. A much larger percentage, 18.1% of children, are both stunted and underweight. These conditions are a result of insufficient nutrient intake and frequent infections. Stunting can cause irreversible physical and mental impairment, and wasting can lead to death in children under 5. The report finds the prevalence of malnutrition in children between 6 months and 5 years has declined, but that of acute malnutrition or wasting has marginally increased. It notes India now suffers from the double burden of undernutrition and overnutrition. In the last decade, it says the prevalence of low body mass index has decreased by more than one-third in both women and men. During the same period, it says overweight and obesity have increased from 13% to 21% among women and from 9% to 19% among men. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
It's been a rocky year for the relationship between Washington and Silicon Valley. Next year could be even worse. Lawmakers and regulators in the nation's capital are scrutinizing technology firms over a host of issues: competition, online privacy, encryption, bias. These companies are promising action, as are the regulators. Michelle Quinn reports on how the frustrations could lead to new regulations that could have a global impact on how people communicate online.
In Washington, the outrage over Silicon Valley seems to keep mounting.
People are angry and scared more than ever before. And they don't care whether it's a federal law or a state law. They want a law.
It's time to break up these big companies so they don't have so much power over everyone else.
Senators Richard Blumenthal and Elizabeth Warren are among a chorus of lawmakers looking critically at tech companies as powerful gatekeepers. Big tech, as it is now called, is being criticized by both Democrats and Republicans. And in the coming year, the pressure will likely increase. Carl Gardino, president and chief executive of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, represents many of the region's tech firms.
It's fascinating when you think of the relationship between the nation's capital and the world's innovation capital. While it is not headed for divorce court, it is not the blossoming romance that it once was.
Instead of romance, there are now threats of fines over things like violating users' privacy or stifling competition. New laws could give American users more control over their online data. They could also restrict companies' ability to sell user information worth billions of dollars to advertisers. Zoe Lofgren has represented Silicon Valley in Congress since 1994.
Americans, not just Americans, people, internet users around the world are concerned about the privacy of their data, and I think we need to set some rules for that.
Foreign users of American tech products could also see changes if lawmakers follow through on threats to break up large companies like Facebook, transforming its popular apps such as Instagram into a separate competitor. Sally Hubbard is the director of enforcement strategy at the Open Markets Institute, a research group that focuses on antitrust issues.
This is a global issue. These are global monopolies. I do think that people are looking to America to take a leadership role in reining in our own companies.
Garrett Johnson has had a hand in both tech as an entrepreneur and the federal government as a staff member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He is now the executive director of Lincoln Network, a nonprofit organization that aims to bridge the gap between technology and Washington, D.C.
D.C. is waking up to the massive impact that tech has on society, culture, the economy. And Silicon Valley is waking up to the societal impacts that it has, not only on our democracy, but, you know, on the economy, on jobs. And so there's this collision that's happening, and it's just being noticed more now.
At the same time Washington scrutinizes Silicon Valley, there is growing concern over China's expanding role in advanced global communications and whether the authoritarian country can be entrusted with user data. Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University.
If Huawei or any Chinese company is able to build the telecom infrastructure of another country, another city, other places in the world, you have to assume that baked into the Huawei technology is going to be the transfer of all the data back to Chinese supercomputers.
Will Washington break up Facebook or impose tight regulations on user data? How will the global competition with China play out? The answers will likely shape daily communications for the estimated 5 billion people who will be online in 2020. the majority of the world. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
And we're glad to have you with us for VOA Asia Weekend. Well, when it comes to North Korea, there was lots of posturing, but little progress in 2019, as Washington and Pyongyang spent much of the year trying to convince the other side to take the first step in nuclear talks. With North Korea's end-of-year threats and its misguided belief that it can influence the 2020 U.S. presidential election, some fear the Korean Peninsula could return to a state of major tensions, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
2019 began with Kim Jong-un warning he may take a new way if the U.S. didn't soften its stance in nuclear talks. The world may soon find out just what he means by that. Talks broke down after Donald Trump walked away from a February summit with Kim in Hanoi.
They were willing to denuke a large portion of the areas that we wanted, but we couldn't give up all of the sanctions for that. We had to walk away from that.
Within weeks, North Korean rockets began flying and kept flying. By some measures, 2019 was North Korea's busiest year ever for missile launches. Though Trump shrugged off the short-range tests, the talks never got back on track, even after a third Trump-Kim meeting at the demilitarized zone. In October, North Korea was the one to walk away from working-level talks. The North's top nuclear negotiator blamed the U.S.'s old viewpoint and attitude for the breakdown. Now, North Korea is giving signs it may conduct a long-range missile test and is warning on an almost daily basis about Kim's end-of-year deadline, which U.S. officials have ignored. Trump and Kim may soon return to exchanging threats of war instead of handshakes, says analyst Bong Young-sik.
If North Korea engages in provocations to the United States, it will only make Trump to rely on fire and fury, even for the purpose of his re-election.
Bong is one of many analysts who's concerned things may get more tense, in part because North Korea believes it can influence Trump's re-election chances.
The North Koreans are thinking that the world revolves around North Korea. That is very unfortunate and gross miscalculation and misunderstanding by North Korea.
At least some of that perception may be driven by Trump, who's recently linked the two issues. That, despite polls suggesting foreign policy doesn't typically decide U.S. elections, points out analyst John DeLury.
I would say North Korea is extremely low on the list of key issues that are determining the election and that will determine. It would take almost a war, really, for North Korea to have an impact on who the next American president is.
DeLury says there's a danger for miscalculation in 2020 if North Korea really thinks it can influence the U.S. vote.
Those political considerations won't be that significant, and say a provocation that they stage will have a conventional security or even military response, and they'll be surprised because they thought they were able to play U.S. domestic politics when in fact they're not. Everyone knows that the election's not about North Korea.
Nonetheless, North Korea appears to be hardening its stance, recently suggesting denuclearization is off the negotiating table. It's also threatened an ominous Christmas gift to the U.S. Because of comments like that, many fear that Fire and Fury Round 2 could be around the corner. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 2012, NASA's Kepler spacecraft discovered three odd exoplanets circling a 500-million-year-old star some 2,400 light-years away. 2 years later, scientists found that the planets seemed to have a lower density than any planet in the solar system, and that they appeared to be light, fluffy, and resembled cotton candy, the favorite circus treat. A team of scientists led by researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder recently used the Hubble Space Telescope to confirm these earlier findings and find that the planets in the Kepler-51 star system represent a new class of exoplanets nicknamed superpuffs. According to NASA, although they each have a mass that's no more than several times that of Earth, because of their atmospheres of hydrogen and helium are so bloated, they are nearly the size of Jupiter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
It was easily a confusing, perhaps sometimes baffling, year in politics around the world. One thing that gave us just a little bit more clarity was the year in music. VOA's Steve Miller sat down with Border Crossing's host Larry London to revisit some of the hits and misses of 2019.
As 2019 rolls to a close, it's time to look back on something a little bit more fun, the year in music. And for that, we have none other than Larry London, the host of Border Crossing here on VOA, joining us in the studio. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve. I've got some great news to report to you. It's been a fantastic year in music.
Oh, tell us more.
All right. Well, Billboard just recently crowned Post Malone as the Artist of the Year. His third album, Hollywood's Bleeding, topped the charts this past year for 5 weeks, which is longer than any other album.
Really?
And produced his fourth number one hit, which has been number one the past couple of weeks, called Circles. So he's been doing very well. He's out on tour right now. Ten-time Grammy winner Taylor Swift saw her music catalog sold for $300 million to Scooter Braun, who happens to manage a number of artists, including Justin Bieber. And her former record label, Big Machine Records, are the people who sold her record catalog. She's not very happy about that, but she did come up with a solution. She decided to re-record all of her music. So that way she would own what she re-recorded.
So she owns, like, essentially the, what was it, Brooks and Dunn had you know, a re-envisioning of a lot of their number one hits called the Reboot Album. So is she essentially rebooting her music catalog?
She's rebooting all of her biggest hits. And there's been a number of years since she started, obviously, and she's been named by People Magazine as one of the four people they chose to be their People of the Year this past year. Along with that, she received the Artist of the Decade American Music Award, which was the first time that award's ever been given out. She received it from Carole King. She was named Billboard's first Woman of the Decade. And her sixth album, Lover, became her fifth number one album out of the six during her 15 years in the business. This is our place, we made the rules. And there's a dazzling haze, a mysterious way about you, dear. Beyoncé is nominated for four Grammys, talking about the Grammys coming up on January 26th. She didn't really do anything musically, except for the fact that she released a documentary called Homecoming, which features live footage from her Coachella Valley Festival performance. And there's some revealing facts about Beyoncé in that documentary. She's earned 23 Grammys so far, and she has the chance to tie the record set by Alison Krauss, who holds 27 Grammy wins with Beyoncé's four nominations. She had a fantastic year with the live-action remake of The Lion King. Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town. Now, the longest-running number one in Billboard history hit the charts this past year. 19 weeks for Old Town Road from newcomer Lil Nas X, who was also YouTube's most watched video with 470 million views. And that song has won a Country Music Association award for their event of the year. It does feature country artist Billy Ray Cyrus. The song earned the 19-year-old two MTV awards, an American Music Award for Favorite Rap Hip-Hop Song, and was named the Billboard Song of the Year. Hey, now, Steve, new artists this past year include a 17-year-old named Billie Eilish, who won three Apple Music Awards at their inaugural award show. She also received the Best New Artist Award at the American Music Awards. She's nominated for two Grammys January 26th and was named Billboard's Woman of the Year. And she's only 17. She's not really 17. A woman.
And my favorite line in her breakout song is, duh. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type, make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad
type. I'm the bad guy. Duh. I love it. How many hits can have duh? Her album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go, which she co-wrote and produced with her brother Phineas, topped the charts on the success of her number one hit single, Bad Guy. And in memoriam, Steve, to wrap things up, we lost a lot of great musicians
last
year. Ginger Baker from Cream, Eddie Money, Art Neville, Leon Redbone, Daryl Dragon of Captain and Tennille, Dr. John, James Ingram, Peter Tork of the Monkees, Scott Walker from the Walker Brothers, Nipsey Hussle, Doris Day, Rick Ocasek of the Cars, Robert Hunter from Grateful Dead, and just recently, 21-year-old Juice WRLD, who gave us a number one hit called Lucid Dreams, passed away.
Larry London, thank you very much for joining us today in the studio.
Thank you, Steve.
To the point why I love and I hate you, and I cannot change you, so I must replace you. Easier said than done. I thought you were the one listening to my heart instead of my head.
Oh, that list makes me feel old. Well, it's been a year of challenges for President Donald Trump at home and abroad. VOA's Cindy Sain has this look at the foreign policy challenges that are facing the president in 2019 and 2020.
President Donald Trump has established his own unorthodox approach to U.S. foreign policy. He often has harsh words for NATO and other traditional U.S. allies, evident when he blasted Canada's leader, who was caught on video at the recent NATO London summit, apparently making fun of Trump.
Well, he's two-faced.
Yet, he often praises authoritarian leaders, such as Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping, whom he called a good man in a tough business in a tweet. Also notably different from his predecessors are Trump's beautiful letters and visits with North Korea's Kim Jong-un.
And I think that you will have a tremendous future with your country, a great leader.
Trump seems to have a real affinity for authoritarian strongmen, says Francis Brown, who worked at the National Security Council under both the Obama and Trump administrations.
I think oftentimes these strongmen flatter President Trump personally, and he likes that. The problem is that the rest of the U.S. government is trying to push back against strongmen with anti-democratic tendencies.
And polls indicate most Americans have more traditional foreign policy views. 7 in 10 Americans. The 2019 Chicago Council survey shows 78% think the U.S. should maintain or increase its support for NATO, and almost 60% believe promoting democracy and human rights abroad makes the U.S. safer. So it would appear Americans soundly reject a retreat from global alliances, says former U.S. Ambassador to NATO Ivo Dalder.
Only 20% of Americans think what the president thinks, which is that they're beneficial only for the allies. The same is true on trade.
Asked if Trump's foreign policy will matter to American voters in 2020, one expert said some might feel it comes down to character.
I think that perhaps this presidential election round, more than others, people will, I think, be judging just the character and the way the president imports himself to our allies in the world.
Trump's approach to foreign policy may not be decisive at the ballot box next year, given that Americans cite health care, the economy, and immigration as their top issues. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
And you're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. VOA Mandarin Service reporter Paris Wang looks back at the dramatic scenes of revolt in recent months in Hong Kong. What began as protests over a proposed extradition law, meaning Hong Kongers could face trial in China's Communist Party-controlled courts, unleashed years of pent-up frustrations over creeping control by Beijing and an intentional erosion of Cantonese culture. Here, VOA's Paris Wang meets with a first-hand account of his time covering the unrest.
There were protests everywhere. Tear gas.
Extradition bill.
Anti-government rally.
Violence in Hong Kong intensified overnight.
Vandalizing, and you can see the fire. Feel like a war zone. Uh,
I was in Hong Kong from the end of August to the beginning of November, so about 2 months. There are casualties everywhere. I saw a female reporter was carried away. You can find the police being very easily agitated. They get angry right away because I know the protest is getting more and more violent. The Mong Kha station, it was all black. You can see the burn marks. The police asked the metro company. They shut down the metro, so the protesters have nowhere else to go. They enraged the protesters. They say they have the reason to vandalize a lot of stuff. I saw fire. I ran to the fire. I saw the black smoke came out so much. After the smoke disappeared, I saw the sign, Xiaomi store, which is a Chinese cell phone. I remember the China bank, their ATM were all broken. The water were dripping down from the ceiling. The companies owned by the Chinese or supporting the Hong Kongese government, they'll be vandalized. I think there's also difficult for the Hong Kong police to be in that situation for such a long time. They're also very tired. They've been pushed to the limit. And I saw there were several older women were yelling at the police. And I saw the police. They don't know how to react to that. They would just have their hands holding in front of their body. I wouldn't say they're kids, but they look like pretty young. There are so many protests every day, every weekend. I don't see a lot of people in coordinating, but people are just coming out on their own. Also, office workers, they walk into the rally. It finished after the lunch hour and people just went back to work. It's all very organic. And people would do flash mobs. One of the most iconic protest songs on this movement is Glory to Hong Kong. So one time I went to this shopping center called City Plaza. There was this guy playing harmonica. When you turn around, you see it was like 3, 4, 5 stories of the shopping mall. It was full of people. They were all singing Glory to Hong Kong. Send chills to your spine. You will feel that. It's like emotion. The streets are not just for the police and the protesters. Regular Hong Kongese residents live there too. They come out to shop, they come out to eat. At that moment, I can realize how mentally a burden that would be to regular Hong Kong residents.
Thanks to VOA's Paris Huang with the Mandarin Service for that look back.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
Moviegoers in the U.S. and much of the rest of the world can now see Star Wars Episode IX, The Rise of Skywalker. The final installment of the Skywalker saga ends a story that spawned the most successful movie franchise of all time, with more than $9 billion in global box office receipts and counting. The film's release is bittersweet, however, for those who look back and see Star Wars woven through their lives. Among them is VOA's Midwest correspondent, Kane Faribault.
Born exactly 1 month after its theatrical debut in May of 1977, I grew up on a steady diet of Star Wars films, like many other American kids of that era. Through toys and merchandise, I charted the journey of Luke Skywalker from desert farm boy to galactic hero, one of many storylines that filled my imagination.
It's become this one enormous story, and you can take from it the thrill of the battle scenes. You can take from it the affection of the human characters for each other, the love indeed.
No Star Wars movies were released from the mid-1980s to the late 1990s, depriving me of new space battles or love stories in my teenage years. Undaunted, I wrote my own Star Wars screenplays, which I sent to the man I admired, creator George Lucas himself. All were politely returned, unread. Even so, my love for Star Wars never faded.
Star Wars, to me, has been really important in sort of looking beyond just a hero and a villain to larger questions of culture and identity.
Media and cinema studies professor Blair Davis has a simple explanation for people's fascination with Star Wars and devotion to the franchise.
It's telling us older stories about who we are and why we become the people that we seek to become.
While youthful dreams of collaborating on Star Wars projects never came true, they set me on a communications path and are a continuing part of my identity as a fan and a reporter.
For many of these people dressed up in these Star Wars costumes, it's more than just a movie, it's a way of life.
You're certainly not alone in having Star Wars as being so key to who you are, because so many of my students share the same story about what it means to them as fans and then becoming media scholars as well. It tells stories that I think are uniquely human despite all of the aliens on display. They're about family, about finding family, losing family, and about really trying to become the person that you're meant to be.
Family is central to my Star Wars story today. My love of the saga is passed on to my children. I see their imaginations fueled, as mine once was, and continues to be.
What did Han Solo have white hair?
It is sort of the end of an era of one part of the saga, but I look forward to the fact that Star Wars will live on, hopefully longer than I will, and certainly longer than George Lucas.
Although Lucas turned Star Wars over to Disney in 2012, he is still intimately connected to his creation.
It's one of the hottest tickets in town, and not even the rain will keep these fans away from the premiere.
And although he never read my screenplays many years ago, I did have an opportunity to finally speak to him at a London Star Wars film premiere in 2005.
What do you want them to take away from the whole saga?
What it is that caused you to turn to the dark side and what the consequences are.
While the Skywalker saga is ending, fans can take solace. At least three more Star Wars movies are planned for the coming decade. New characters and plot lines sure to emerge. For now, I doubt waiting in line with my children to see Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker.
We'll always be with you.
Or this very report.
No one's ever really gone.
Will be the end of my continuing Star Wars journey. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
The force is strong with that one. Well, that's VOA Asia Weekend for this New Year's holiday. Thanks so much for being with us all year, and we look forward to meeting you again in 2020. And until then, here's hoping you have a happy and prosperous New Year. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Be well.